Ain't no party like a Vibrant party. What's up, everybody? It's Wednesday. It's going to be a good one tonight. See some awesome folks in the chat already. Thunder Chicken, how you doing? Hope you're enjoying freedom. Kabir, Priscilla, Jenny G. Who else we got in the house? Love it that we're live right now. It's always the highlight of the week right there in the middle. That's why I put it there. And tonight we're going to be talking about something rather important, but I think we'll still have fun. The education of children. what a charged topic. But I think with, I put in the description, the word polymath or no, what was it? Philomath. That's the word. Lover of learning, right? I think that pretty much the audience in this crowd, they're all philomaths. And so the topic of education and training our youth to be more autodidactic in the way they approach the world and their confidence about their ability to learn things that they want to learn rather than sort of waiting for permission from authority and only learning what is by the book through the officially sanctioned textbooks and all that. You know, I don't think we're strangers to this alternative way of doing things, but I'm really excited to talk to my old friend John Coleman tonight about this stuff. He's sort of an expert in the field, and I think we'll all leave this conversation, whether or not we have kids yet, more confident about our ability to take responsibility for this all too important aspect of the development of life. So welcome, John. How you been since the last time we hung out?
Good. I'm well. Thanks, Chance and Gabriel. Nice to see you as well. Golly, I'm trying to think. We haven't spoken in person or digital persons or whatever. I think we've done a bit of emails, but in terms of recording anything, I think it was with Howdy maybe 3 years ago, was it? About this time, I think maybe February, about 3 years ago. So since then, I've been busy for sure.
Oh, yeah. We did that World's Fair episode. Totally forgot about that. I was just thinking about the last time we talked to education. Cool. Yeah. The time just flies. It's been, it's been a weird couple of years since then, that's for sure. But everything's better than ever on my end. And, you know, you're looking well, you're looking healthy. Where are we at with your work? Or maybe introduce your work to people that are new, because I'm sure there's lots of folks that have jumped on board this stream since then and never actually caught the old stuff that we did together.
Sure. Yes. Thank you, Chance. What a good question. As of this recording this week and this month, we're really celebrating our 10th anniversary. And what is that anniversary of? But it's a Stasis Institute, which is a college. And we're putting feelers out into great education these days as well. And basically, in a nutshell, what we've been trying to do, myself and the other instructors over these years, and I think since we spoke last, I can speak in the plural. We have some other cats on board, too, so that helps things immensely. But what we're trying to do is both address the what I would see as errors of mainstream education or factory learning or Rockefeller learning or however you want to phrase that. Those errors, which I think are well known enough amongst your audience, but also to address what I also see as an equal slide in a lot of alternative modalities of education as well, a certain, in my opinion, sloppiness and try to maintain in both those tendencies, trying to maintain what is good in formal education, what is good in long-term instruction, what is good in this whole idea of an academic journey and building these very complex ideas, which often do need that sort of discipline and that interaction with a single scholar or a clutch of scholars over a long time. So to address both the drifts on both sides whilst maintaining what's good in the classroom. That's what we're about.
So I think it was just you last time. You didn't have collaborators, right?
Yes, we have Dr. E. Michael Fisher up in Canada with our Fearology Center. And his focus is just on that, on the role of fear, and academically speaking, on the role of fear in different aspects of history and sociology and our own lives and so forth, how that's manipulated and how we overcome that to be more agentic, more free individuals. So we have Dr. Fisher there, as I say. We have Professor David Rios with the arts, in particular, the plastic arts, as they're called. We had Ian Spellman out in Taiwan before he had to see to some passport requirements, and we'll lasso him back. And more recently, we have as consultants working on our folk music and social change center, Paula DeAngelis and David Rovix, who's done quite a bit of singing for the past 30 years. So he's not just academically interested in folk ways, but also has lived it himself. So those are some of the talents that we have, and great talents. They are Adam Myers with mathematics as well.
Man, so you've really put a super team together. That is awesome. The growth, it's a big step. I mean, going from doing stuff alone to, you know, when something that's kind of your baby and your thing, to be able to trust to bring somebody else in to take, you know, care of aspects of it or let it grow. That's a big step. And the name of the Institute is it's a great word. It was a bit of a mouthful, apocatastasis. And I wanted to talk maybe just about that and how that word fits around the core philosophy of what you do. So I know what that word means, but maybe you can share what it's about.
Sure. So the word apokatastasis is a Greek word, and indeed it is a mouthful, as you say. The first person to mention that. And it means restoration. It means restoration, and it does in certain traditions have philosophical or theological connotations, but regardless, whether it's the general meaning or the more specific meanings, the word apokatastasis means restoration, but it has the connotation in whatever usage of the idea of the restoration is greater than it was before. So if I knock a book off of the shelf on this level, so to speak, there's a connotation as a verb as apokatastasis, that it would, if the book fell off on this shelf, when you restore it, you replace it, it is at a higher level than it was before. So as regards education, you know, we have what we deal with, and this is the circumstances, and we take what we can with what's good in the system, so to speak, and what's good in the classroom, but we try to make it better. We try to take out the dross and try to make it better. So that is that idea of restoration, not just putting things back to where they were at some mythological, I don't want to say fictional, but some, you know, some idea, some golden age, not just trying to put it back or set back the clock, but, you know, really to take formal learning and to make it better than it was before. So there you go.
I like that a lot. And the mythological connotation just fascinates me to no end, because I mean, I've been interested in this particular subject anyway, but lately I've been trying to put together my notes on like the different versions of this idea from various religious mythological traditions. And so it's across the board. It seems that like all the ancient mystery cults had this idea of the destruction and restoration of the world in periodical cycles. In Christian theology, the word apokatastasis is about the after, you know, the end of all things, then God puts everything back where it was, but in a perfected state like it was in the beginning. So like this cyclical destruction and regeneration aspect of the mythos is fascinating. And so, you know, it's contentious. Like, do we all just relive the exact same lives on repeat, like just putting the movie back in the player or what? But I just think that that's a cool concept, because it's like nothing is irredeemable. It almost is like inclusive of the good intentions that exist in the education system, rather than making it like this divisive enemy to fight. You know, I prefer to take personal responsibility for this all important thing, but I want to kick it over to Gabe. My friend, what do you got brewing in your mind just as we open up on this topic?
Well, I love that the word itself encourages you to research it. I love words that do that, that draw you into a self-education. And so, yeah, it is a great word choice. And thank you for explaining it, because that really is optimistic, has a spirit of optimism. And not just that everything's going to be all right, that everything's going to excel. But yeah, that's a great word.
Thank you.
So let's talk about, you know, one thing that comes to mind for me is I've talked about, you know, with my folks, for example, how when I have kids, I'm going to want to take charge of their education. I'm not going to want to send them to other people unless, you know, maybe there's a collaborative effort and it's, you know, I'm involved and it's trusted and all that. Sure. But what I hear certain things that are basically, you know, consistent pushback, sort of like when you say that you don't really want a federal government, they go, what about the roads? And with education, the one that always comes up is like, well, your kid's not going to have any social skills. And I wonder, you know, because I know a lot of folks here already are kind of convinced that the mainstream education model is not for them or for their family. But if it were, you know, if you were to be able to give us kind of the bullet points of things that people listening can internalize so that when they talk about this to family or to, you know, their children's grandparents or maybe even a spouse that's on the fence, like what, you know, how to address the common potential concerns like social skills that might come up whenever we're leaving the box of what is familiar and old.
Sure. Thank you for that. Yeah. And that's a big thing. And especially in our society, because of the nature of the middle class, we're all middle class in a sense. We all think like the middle class. There's always that basically, am I fitting in? Because of the nature of the middle class is a man of the city. The bourgeois is literally a city man. And so, you know, we all have that by nature, I think, to, you know, see what everyone else is doing. But I think especially in the past couple hundred years, as society has developed, we're always, you know, seeing, are we like the herd? And that's usually not a good thing. certainly in our time, and it's manipulated tremendously. But, you know, this is our conditioning and wanting to bring a more agentic, a word that I'll be using a lot in our time together, agency, initiative, it has that connotation, initiative, freedom, I suppose, is a part of that. Wanting to develop that, we do have to challenge a lot of the bumper stickers and a lot of the fears that we've been manipulated with and we've taken on, and a lot of these subtle things. And so when it comes to things like socialization, which is a very, very common one that one hears, we get back to the reality that community is work. Community is work. And when we look at this topic, socialization, we are asked to really confront something else that we've been manipulated with, which is this whole consumeristic ethos, which the enemy ruling class of this country deliberately set up around the year 1980 in this country, really when the stops came out, you were going to shift society from the liberal nation state citizen, which had its own problems, certainly. But that whole ethos now we've been given in the past 30, 40 years to be the consumer. So getting back to education, socialization, right? Oh, I think I need to send my child to, I can farm out my child to the school to do that job. And it's the same idea. Well, I can farm out my child to send them to the school because it's their job to teach. And this is fundamentally, whether it's socialization or education or whatever other things we've attached to schooling, this is fundamentally something we need to scotch in ourselves, is this whole idea of this service sector attitude when it comes to education. So getting back to your point, Chance and Gabriel, about just socialization, is community is work. And whether you are sending your child to the public school or the private school or the homeschool co-op, you're going to do the unschool thing or whatever, or something in between there, you're not a consumer. You're not in this earth to be a consumer. If you want your child to be socialized, you need to be socialized, and you need to, you need to be involved in your community in any instance. And so when we have this topic, you know, hopefully I've addressed it. You got to take the bull by the horns in any scenario. You can't just farm it out. If you're thinking you can just go into the school and send the kid to the school and they'll be socialized, that's not going to happen. And how do you know that? because in this society, there's more classrooms in America. I mean, I think it's, I forget the number. It's like 30% of Americans are in a classroom, you know, at a given point, if you average it all out, some crazy number. That's a huge number. But okay, and we've been formed in this modern pedagogy. Okay, well, go on the street. People don't even look at you. So, I mean, really, this mainstream stuff, and I'm not just picking on the public schools, because the homeschools and the private schools, they have the exact same model. I mean, it has not produced a society of socialized people. Everyone, no one wants to talk to you. You say hi to people, they want to run away. I say hi to people in the park, and they look like you're a Freddy Krueger or something. People are scared, they're timorous. So this, anyway, I'll put a sock in it, but let us challenge ourselves about the consumeristic ethos under such a question, which we, it's a very common question, and then realize whatever happens as mommy and daddy, you got to take the bull by the horns, and our community is work. So there you go.
Man, that's a really well thought out answer. I love how eloquent you are, John. You know, I you always tell when you're talking to somebody who reads a lot and writes a lot, there's just a different flow to the conversation. And I appreciate it. Your response sounded like the quality of an essay, but with the conversational rhythm of something just naturally coming from the heart. So I think that's really cool. And I also agree that you pretty much nailed it. The social schools that kids learn in school these days is how to be so immersed in a mass of sort of faceless crowd that they gain the skill of ignoring humans around them. Or gain bad social habits of sort of like click mentality and a negative type of in-group preference, or even, you know, especially in certain age ranges of public school, it's just inescapable that kids are going to bully and be bullied. And of course, that's, you know, there's some natural, that's somewhat of a natural thing that is meant to be grown through. But my point being, how many of us, you know, raise your hands if you spent a few good years of your life just trying to work out what kind of conditioning you received by being in school and get back to being a real human being, you know? So these are all really good points. And I think if, you know, my intuition about it is that even if your child is going to maybe encounter a lower volume of people than they would if they were in the factory, if you will, I think, you know, what I know about children is that if they didn't get this conditioning that other people could potentially just be a nameless face to ignore in a big sea of strangers, that the people they do meet in their life would maybe be a little bit more special and important to them, and they'd be more interested in the people they meet. It's a quality over quantity thing, things like that. You know, all of this makes sense to me.
Yes, and it's that's really hitting the nerve, this quality over quantity. I have behind me a book that was very influential, and I would recommend it to your future pedagogues and your audience. This is Ivan Ilyich's De-Schooling Society. And this gentleman was a sociologist of sorts, and he was very interested in obviously education and society, but in this book, he uses the idea of transportation and making a parallel to education and quality over quantity. He noticed just that, just as we are, you know, we think if we go to the big school, that quantity of individuals we will come across, mommy and daddy think, well, that must produce socialization. No one can define that necessarily, but we all have these buzz terms. And Ivan Ilyich said, well, look at the car. And he points out how, and other people did this before him, in fact, with inventions, it didn't necessarily, it improved the speed of the movement, but it wasn't objectively necessarily a better thing, because then you have to pave all this land, you have all these animals and people that get run over all the time, and so forth. And if you try to quantify it, you almost end up back at the horse and buggy. I mean, what was better? And so the same way, I mean, just like transportation is a far more you know, more complicated at least. And it isn't necessarily the dynamics altogether changed with the train and the automobile. And the perception of reality changed, and also people's interactions changed because of those machines. Likewise, with the school, the industrial school, just like the industrial transportation, like you say, finally, quantity doesn't equal quality altogether. And once again, community is work in any instance.
Gabe, I'm calling on you again.
Thank you, buddy. I love the that phrase. I forget who this quote is from. To be well adjusted to a truly sick society is no measure of mental health. And what's fascinating about that statement is you don't go to school for mental health. You go to school to learn stuff. Mental health is on the private side. And so putting your kids through school is, sure, they're getting whatever, but they're not getting mental health. That's just not a priority for those schools. And then I have another phrase, another kind of, this is conspiratorial. It's kind of dark. It's kind of provocative. But I have another mental experiment to share with you. And it is this phrase, this question: what Pavlovian sound were the public school students conditioned classically to close their books, stop thinking, and move or struggle against child traffic for class mobility? These are the ingredients of transitioning from one theme of thinking into the next theme of thinking, and we did it seven times a day. And the answer to the question is the word bell ding. When the bell dings, you stop thinking, you close your books, you move into child traffic, and you go struggle to get to the next class. These terms have different meaning when you're an adult. And the answer, Bill Belding, has a twilight echo. And that echo is buildings. And today, with all of the earthquakes and all the blowing things up, the word building is a very triggering term. And so the Pavlovian aspect of the building is also, it's incurred more meaning around the fact that now there are buildings are going to be collapsing, and that's going to have people, it's infantilizing, actually, these programs that brings you back to your youth. And so you get put instantly into a receptive position, even as an adult. So I just wanted to kind of put some conspiratorial context to the terms of the school that are still taking on kind of nefarious and scary meaning as adults. Mm.
Well, to that point, something that strikes me on those comments concerns a guest of Chance's in the past, I believe, Clint Richardson. I believe you've spoken to Clint, haven't you, Chance?
Quite a few times, yeah. He's a buddy.
And I recall in Clint's, way of cutting through things and often cutting through the rhetoric of certain communities, that he pointed that out about the idea of public schools. And I am careful again and again in my comments here to point out that the model that I'm about to describe is used in homeschooling and in all these private schools too. So I'm not just picking on the public school, but Clint had pointed out, what is the purpose of the public school? And we get so angry about the public school, and they look at these books and look at this, they're dumbing us down, and the Department of Education and the unions and all of this stuff. And all of this good stuff that Gabriel just brought up too, all this occultic aspect, which I definitely am jiving with. But public schools' job is to make fundamentally public people. And then you have to ask yourself, what is the word public mean? And that means, and this is not my stuff, this is Clint and a whole other, whole bunch of people's excellent research. And you don't have to take our word for it. Just look at their big old Black's dictionary and all this jazz. What's public? It's commercial. So all of this conditioning that Gabriel just laid out is to make public people. And then all of a sudden, the wicked public schools and the school boards and all this, and we thought they were bad guys. All of a sudden, we realized the most honest people in the world. They told you on their marquees. They told you we're making public people. And once again, getting back to the holding the bull by the horns and taking agency. If mommy and daddy send Junior to public school, why are they getting angry that public school Jimmy is coming back and his love of learning is gone and he's become a drone and he's depressed and all of these misery that you see amongst the students in these factory schools? Well, mommy and daddy should have learned what the word public meant. So there is a deep aspect. And in a lot of my my writings this year, I'm trying to invite people to ask that, you know, and to ask the question, you know, look at this society. We all complain about this. I watch your show and I watch shows like it. And I know that I make the same complaints. And we look at society and the politics and the conspiracies, and we see millions of people involved in this on some level of complicity. Getting back to education, they were all little boys and girls once. And so if we can set that right, that's one way, a major way to strike a blow against these criminal combinations. But we need the long vision right now to see what's going on, and we need that long-term vision to correct it.
Yeah, man, I just love that entire segment right there. You know, Gabe brought it all home to the truth of the matter, that it's all in plain sight, but it's also not as it appears to the average person. And why I wanted to talk to you again and keep you in my roster of people to consider for shows is because you're hip and savvy to the deeper level of this, you know, the crimes perpetrated in the name of public fill in the blank are endless. I mean, we just, since we last spoke, of course, we saw the atrocities done in the name of public health. And that's something Clint was ringing the bell about way before the cooties situation popped off. So I really appreciate that this perspective, you know, the deep aspect of this, the truly spiritual nature of this concept of public and private is being brought to the forefront of this talk right away. That's excellent, because it's extremely relevant. And it's not that we can't operate in the public while also maintaining our private rights, but if there was one thing that a true education ought to instill in somebody, is that there is such a dichotomy, and that your rights actually function differently as a person versus as a living man or woman. And to know when and where to apply that personhood for business dealings and the commercial aspect, you know, it has its place. There's liability protection in that it wasn't necessarily created with purely evil intent, you know, whenever this Roman law system came into existence, I don't think, but it certainly has been leveraged in a knowledge differential to allow, you know, some people to act with impunity and other people to live out their fantasy victimhood experience of no need for responsibility because someone else will do it for me and I can't do it because someone else is doing it to me. You know, it's sort of like an infinite feedback loop. So I love that we've gone there, John.
Great. Thank you. Yes. Yeah. It does get very deep, and it's amazing. The way traumas are marshaled for this system to produce the public person, it's so well oiled, and yet we go along with it so much. I see we, in the general sense, as a society, because and we saw this in giant Hollywood sized letters during the COVID time, because convenience is there. And we love our convenience. Every time I buy Amazon, I'm putting the noose around my neck, but it's so convenient. It's so convenient. That is really that old saying, we have met the enemy and he is us in so many ways there. We're so comfortable. We love our comfort so much. And that combined with a trauma makes a very passive society, which can be milked and used in various ways.
And I'd like to, okay, Gabe, go for it, buddy.
Thank you. John, are you familiar with Howard Gardner's multiple intelligence theory?
Not off the cuff. I think I've heard of the name, but please tell us about him.
So when I was in college, I was very focused on special education, and I was learning about multiple intelligence theory, which is a kind of an open-ended theory. That's one of the nice things about it. But he has established that intelligence, broadly defined, is useful skill sets for a community. It really goes in stride with what you're saying, that community is work. And so he identified seven specific skill sets: math, interpersonal and interpersonal. Those are two different ones. Music, language, and a couple more. And he always makes a point to say, somebody will come along and find other intelligences to add to the list. So it's not exclusive to the seven. And it's a very encouraging, when I was young, it was very encouraging that maybe we can renovate the education system. So the mantra is that the school is molded to fit the student as opposed to the other way around. And so it's incumbent on the school to have the adaptability and the ability to adjust to the individual needs. And I've actually heard Jordan Peterson, everybody's favorite, I heard him kick down multiple intelligence theory. He dismissed it very quickly in a single phrase. I think he says, the research proves that multiple intelligence theory is nothing more than multiple talents. I think he used the word talent and then just moved on like that, like it debunked it or something. I don't think it can be debunked. I think it's very valuable. I just wanted to feel out if that's ever come across your radar. And his name is Howard Gardiner. I'm 90% sure. Mm. And I think I'm just curious if that's still circulating or if they snuffed it out, because it really does renovate education fundamentally to say that it's on the school to meet the individual needs. That is a total flip of the mentality of the collective, really.
Mm. Yes, I must learn more about Mr. Gardiner here and this particular idea. The problem, as I see it, is not with this idea, but implementing it in the mainstream schools, and not just public, but again, the other models is, in the public schools, again, fundamentally, their job is to make an individual who will be as successful as possible living his birth certificate person in this commercial society. So the beauty of Mr. Gardner's ideas here, I can't imagine ever could really be implemented on the public school model, because its telos is in contradiction. And it's not that the public school or those models are, and again, the private schools and the homeschools are all geared fundamentally towards the same, to make a successful person in this economy. But obviously you have that, you have those individuals. I mean, there are, especially on the lower end, like among the departments and the teachers themselves, these ideas percolate. There are these, even in the public system, there are the alternative schools, which often have the smartest people in them, even though the children have been made to feel like outcasts. Often those are the best teachers in those schools and the best students, not in the quantifiable way, but they still have some soul in their eyes and things in their heart. But I think whether it's Mr. Gardner's idea of multiple intelligence theory, or even something like John Dewey, who gets a lot of bad rap and maybe it's some rotten philosophy, but even John Dewey's ideas are not really implemented in the schools either, because and there are, everyone knows this, every 20 years is another major fad in education. And increasingly, the past two or three rounds of it's come out of Washington. So you got your No Child Left Behind and Obama education and all this jazz. What was that Obama education? What was that? The testing thing. Help me out. Common Core. The fads come and go, and sometimes they're good, and sometimes, like this sounds like it is, and some of this other stuff are the IEPs, individual education plans, and so forth for those with special needs and all. But I cannot imagine these things ever really being implemented, because if they were fundamentally implemented across the board, public, private, homeschool, you would have a completely different society. And the masters of this education won't allow that. They won't allow that. I like this idea, though, because it does challenge, just like Ilyich does and some of the other dudes. It does really ask us and challenge us, what type of society do we want? And just like we saw with COVID, like Chance was saying, one of the things we saw in COVID was the choke points in the society are held. That's how that thing was able to happen. You didn't have to control everyone. You control the licensing, and you basically, that was it. You control the licensing and you could control the medicine and the cops and the restaurants and all this stuff. And likewise with the schools, it's the masters of that system. They have the choke point, and that's the difficulty of implementing beautiful ideas like what you laid out, Gabriel.
I want to highlight this comment from James at Family Fungi. He says, being homeschooled for the most part without a curriculum forced my sister and I to become autodidacts. This is such a great freedom. I love that he made this comment right when he did. And shout out to James and Elise and their beautiful family. They're just awesome. The question, because where I wanted to take the conversation from here is, you know, there's a few questions that I want to bring to the table and see if we can work around them. So what I see is that a more natural childhood would not require a curriculum per se. The real question is always that, you hear this all the time, not being taught what to learn, but how to learn. And, so the questions I have for you, John, what's your take on what intelligence even is? Is there a true metric for that that's not a standardized test? Is it something that can be increased? Because I think personally that learning to recognize patterns, teaching patterns of how life is structured, that is something that increases intelligence, because you know what you're looking at when you see it. I'm reading this this book right now about evolutionary herbalism. And rather than being just a plant by plant catalog of this Latin name genus is good for these conditions, and here's the vocabulary words that, from the glossary that fit to attach to this name of this plant, all of this is very much the same model as like personhood. You're learning through nouns, these are not. These categorization systems, although they have value to, our ability to communicate to one another, they don't have value, in my opinion, as a true metric of intelligence, this rote memorization. Whereas in this book I'm describing, evolutionary herbalism, it teaches the patterns of how life is structured, how life works, through astrology, through, the principles of alchemy, the salt, mercury, sulfur, and by internalizing these type of like fractal patterns and structures, the goal would be, and I can see it, from this book, that someone that really studied this book and got it into their head, that they would be able to look at plants and know what their virtues were without ever having seen that plant before and feel confident about that just intuitive knowing. And I think that that's like a real metric of intelligence. So I guess, the question in all this is, of course, about intelligence, but also, is there any reason to believe that certain subjects must be learned in a certain order at a certain time? Because how I, vision future children of mine learning might be more like what James describes in a non-curriculative way, where I teach them their letters and the reading at a early age when their minds are primed for that. But then otherwise, maybe focus more on skills and teaching things that they become interested in naturally, and trusting that inquisitiveness of a child and just of a human being that's unconditioned to seek out the knowledge that it wants, rather than needing to stuff their heads 8 hours a day with these facts and memorizations and this man at this date did this historical act, maybe teaching a big picture stories and this patterns of how things flow and letting them take their natural course from there. Cause I look at James from Family Fungi and he's one of the most intelligent people I know, especially in the fields that he's genius in. And I know that's all completely like self-driven and self-inspired.
Great. Well, thank you for that. Do you want to say something, Gabriel, first? Okay. A little bit of a lag there.
Yeah, you can go for it, John.
Okay. Gabriel can jump in when he wants there. So I definitely agree. It's more important to keep that inquisitive spark alive more than any alleged intelligence, quantifiable intelligence. And, you know, the farther we move, I think now a lot of the growing pains in society are the fact that we have, in a lot of ways, a very 19th century way of looking at life, very enlightenment, very, very structured, very much in the ice cube trays. Think about, the way the class day itself is broken up into very isolated segments with the teachers that don't coordinate, and they have this outline of what to be learned when, and you learn the periodic table of elements and all of it. All of reality is broken up, and we can see that in so many ways. The very 19th century way of looking at things, and we see a lot of that is carried on in the schools. In any case, what's more important is to keep that inquisitiveness alive. And I definitely agree with you, probably until puberty, really, formal instruction is not that useful. I mean, you can have the odd class or whatever, but mommy and daddy ought to be capable of teaching junior to write and to read and to not lose that spark. They're probably going to be much better at that than the present system. And that's not any slam on teachers in the system. It's the system itself snuffs out the inquisitiveness, the wonder of the youth as it's designed to. It's not the teachers are malicious. The system is designed in childhood to snuff out the inquisitiveness.
And that's why when reading is an assignment, that it takes the magic out.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why by the time you get to puberty and to high school age, right, it is all become onerous, just like you say. It's become the burden. Yes, sir.
Sorry. John, what is your experience age group that you have the most with, and which is your favorite to work with in terms of age of curriculum? What level do you prefer? And then my other question is any particular subjects that you really light up for?
Sure. So in my, I don't know what, 18 years teaching now, I've taught from 6 to probably 60. And we have a fair smattering at any time at Apocasistasis of students, mostly high school and either these days it tends to be high school or people looking for continuing education later on in life out of the traditional college years. So it's interesting in that regard. But having that footprint of life over these years, I have the most experience with high schoolers, and I like that the most, actually. And having just finished a book on this and some upcoming essays on my first 12 years teaching, one of the things I've had a hell of a problem with is parents, because the parents over the years, often, you know, kind of in these alternative communities, they want their kid to be successful in this society. And often I can tell the society to piss off. And there's often a certain tension that arises between me and parents on those grounds. Fundamentally is because of the assumptions about what education is. And even a lot of these communities, they see a lot of the problems surface level, but they don't, you know, I don't want to be too specific and I don't want to pin any one group down, but a lot of people can see the problem, but they don't ask the deeper aspects of what society this is forming. Like we can get up in arms about, you know, oh, look what the teacher's teaching, or do you hear this crazy thing or whatever, but we're not asking, in my opinion, like, the whole idea of the student having different teachers, changing that at least each year, that is far more disordered than some of these sexual eccentric books or whatever. That's messed up too, but it's way more messed up, the changing out of teachers in the life of a student. And it's those deeper questions I find alternative education people aren't really asking. And so that has led to blowups. That's not actually to your question necessarily, but I like high schoolers and trying to keep that spark alive has often led to tensions with mommy and daddy, let's say.
So I think that if there was something I wanted to leave people with in terms of just reducing the fear levels around taking into your own hands the education of your kid, I think a lot of us are, even that want that, probably are still completely traumatized by our own experience in school. And so whenever we imagine taking on the role of teacher to our own children, we're looking at it through that conditioning of the classroom, and all of the baggage that entails. But would you agree, or could you speak to maybe it actually being potentially simpler than all that, and maybe the bar being a lot lower for success than the struggle that is induced by what, you know, all of us normies, you know, early life normies went through?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of that trauma, and we see that in, I think, a lot of the anti-intellectualism which has come into alternative education, and this suspicion, this evil suspicion of teachers and so forth, which is ginned up by the social media. And we need to be very careful that we're not being played. You know, Joe Blow woke dude over there, he's being played by the social media. However we define our worldviews, when we see, oh, look at that crazy thing happening in the school over there, be careful that that's not being set up. And that's a whole topic we can look at, but I want to say on topic with your thing about reducing fear for parents. So we have a lot of this fear. I think a lot of that trauma is portrayed and thrown onto teachers unjustly, ginned up and exacerbated by the media. So we need to realize how much we've been messed up by this system. And chill out and deprogram from that. And that takes, like you pointed out, you know, all of one's 20s, maybe, or 30s. But beyond
still
that,
still working on it.
Yeah, beyond that, to your earlier point, I would say that when it comes to formal education after a puberty through college, I would say that more structure in terms of really able to grasp certain sciences is necessary. And that doesn't necessarily mean that path is for every student. So I kind of see for the younger grades.
But at that point, they're like, you know, they're capable of taking it into their own hands.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, ideally, what you would have is a child whose inquisitiveness has not been snuffed out. And that I think, for all my griping about homeschooling, I'm not an enemy of homeschoolers, really not. But for all my griping, I think that's an excellent part of that community, is that a lot of the emotional trauma that you see in the factory schools isn't present amongst them. And that allows the child, like you say, Chance, by the time you get to high school, to engage in that systematic approach to knowledge, which can be helpful. So about the parents, though, let's get back to them, to your second more recent question. Having laid out how I kind of see the progression, very kind of unschooled for the childhood, and then more structure for certain souls by high school age, let's say. Having laid that out, especially for the early years, what's most important is really not what's taught to the student, and really the teaching shouldn't be all that formal in the early years through puberty. But what's more important is to have that atmosphere and mommy and daddy. And I would say actually daddy needs to lead in this, especially. That's one of my gripes about homeschooling, is that there really does need to be a lot more masculine leadership in it, especially for boys. Because if you just leave the mommy to take care of the education, the boys don't care about it. They always see it as a feminine thing and they don't pursue it. But in any case,
that is a huge point. That's a huge point.
Yeah. And that's something to think about for the audience here is the fathers need to lead. It cannot be mommy's job. The father needs to lead. He needs to find out a way to do that. If you want your sons in particular to be men of alim, to be men of knowledge, if you want your sons just to be dummies when they get to be teenagers because they associated learning with mommy and femininity, that's on you, daddy. You got to figure out, you want men of knowledge, you want to rear men of knowledge, you got to be in charge of their education. Anyway, you can see my voice is it's changing up a little bit. not like I've thought about this for 20 years. But in any case, what's most important is not what's taught. It's not the structure. Everyone needs to chill out about that. You don't need to do what a lot of dear people do when they first get into homeschooling and make like a little classroom in their house with a little board and a little pledge of allegiance. And it's all very cute, but you don't have to do all you can if you want, but you don't have to do that. What's most important is that there is the presence of knowledge, that the parents are living a life of knowledge, however that is lived in the house, and that
listening to Interverse. Obviously.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Chance and Gabriel here. Absolutely. And also to really get rid of that evil suspicion about teachers. So when the kid gets to be a time where he can appreciate formal instruction, there isn't this tension that we see so often between the family, the unschooling family, the homeschooling family, and the teacher or the tutor or whatever. We really need to step away from a lot of that rhetoric. Oh, the schools are brainwashing camps and the teacher's up to no good, and realize the system, realize the problems, but also chill out a little bit with some of this rhetoric, because this whole system's going to come down, and this whole system, school system and other systems too, at some point. Where our mind is thinking out is rebuilding this, and we're going to need the talents of the people in that debris when the public schools come down and all of this stuff. So let's not burn all our bridges. Let's just chill out. Not all the teachers are out to get you. Not everything's a brainwashing camp. So anyway, that's my response to that. Just have the environment of learning and not to see formal teachers as enemies.
And I love that too, because that having that enemy perception, that divisive nature of it's creating a type of, it perpetuates the whole like victim model of thinking in the first place, rather than, you know, if we want to properly socialize kids, then we don't want them from a young age having this like enemy group, or, you know, they meet another kid who happens to go to public school and now they have this opinion of like, oh, they're a dummy, or oh, they're brainwashed, and there's the superiority complex that can come from that. I really like that balanced mindset you have. Like, yeah, we acknowledge the problems, but we're not here to pick fights or make enemies. We're just in it for the philosophy and the truth that we can find. So I really like that. There's a good question here in the chat that where the question is about your thoughts on. Oh, Gabe, you want in? I'll hold this thought. Yeah. Okay. John, what are your thoughts on like experience model learning, such as apprenticeship? Is that something that is, you know, on your radar, or part of what you would consider to be an important endeavor for somebody to develop properly?
Oh, yes. What's the old saying? You can spend a dollar, but you can never spend a trade. And that's very wise. That staying is very wise. And
it's kind of like talents being a currency and an aptitude, like the word talent.
Absolutely. Yeah, the trades are excellent. I personally wish I was taught a trade. I feel it is criminal that men and women are not given trades, at least in the old days. They you know, hardly the good old days, but, you know, at least in the 50s and 60s, they gave you home ec and they gave you, you know, a shop and things like that. We don't even get that stuff now. But in any case, no, formal trade and formal learning of actual trades and certifications and things is good. We have a great school over in Danbury, Abbott Tech, that does that for the high schoolers and then night classes for the grown-ups. But yeah, that's absolutely a thing. And you see that more even with different colleges, too. The incorporation of the community, and that really does bring in it stops that bifurcation between, you know, formal book learning, let's say, and the hands-on stuff, and it draws in the community with these apprenticeships and these certifications and things like that. Absolutely, I think that's great, and frankly, whilst everyone ought to have access to formal education, in reality, only a certain percentage of people, and probably a smaller minority than we might think, are really capable of systematically studying in a high school setting as we have it, or a college setting. I think I don't know the number, but certainly not 100%. And so most people probably, and not that the trades are for unintelligent people at all, but formal learning is for a certain, talking about different intelligences like Gabriel brought up with the gentleman, a lot of people would learn better and live better with those trades. And I don't just mean economically. And that formal learning is not for everyone. And one of the problems of modern pedagogy, and this is... this is certainly a consequence, whether it's deliberate or not. Okay, I think it is. Carol Quigley gets into this in Tragedy and Hope, actually, towards the end. One of the fruits of modern pedagogy, Rockefeller pedagogy, perhaps intentional or not, is that a certain percentage of people are completely discouraged by learning, having gone through this system. They feel they are dumb. They feel it's not for them. I know people like this in their school years. They're now whatever age, very middle age, let's say. But in their school years, they got it into their head that books were not for me because they got discouraged in that way of learning. And so a certain percentage of the people put through these pedagogy, they just drop out of learning for the rest of their lives. I think the trades are probably for most people, and that would avoid the discouragement that you see in where everyone just funneled through formal book learning. And that way, when you get to be 25, 30, 40, whatever, then you can come back and you're not burned out from learning. You have a trade, you're all set up there, and now you can come back to the books. And so I think that's excellent to that questioner. That's an excellent point they bring up, and I give you two thumbs up on that.
I think that there's another part of learning a trade or a hands-on skill that, I don't know if it's especially for men or what, but speaking as a man, I concluded my university studies, got a bachelor's degree in English, creative writing, believe it or not. So I'm not exactly doing that, maybe, you know, creatively writing out loud as I speak. But hey, the point being, when I completed my degree, I think that was the most depressed I ever have been in my life. And you'd think that, right? You'd think that at that point you'd be like, yeah, finally, all these years of education and working towards this one goal, I did it. But instead, how I felt was completely empty. And that, you know, it took me a little while of stewing in it to really even understand why I felt so empty. I was avoidant of work. I'm avoidant of attention. The only thing that kind of kept me hanging on was I did have a class in my junior year of college that taught meditation. And thank God I did, because that at that point in my life, it was is what I needed to hang on. I also had a good class around that time about, right? Like, there's a really interesting professor who taught a class. He was an Orthodox Christian guy, and he taught a class about writing the spiritual journey. And it was like, no wrong answers, just write about your thoughts about certain spiritual questions. And that was a really helpful class to me too, because it sort of reignited me asking the big questions. But all that aside, I had this like deep emptiness when I completed my degree. And I can't be the only one that felt this way. And it, after stewing in it, I realized that the issue was that I was this pure consumer that created nothing. And so, you know, I picked up some Sharpies and started making some like doodles and trying to learn how to make, learn some Adobe programs that allowed me to do some design stuff. Yeah. And felt, you know, what invigorated me to do that was getting into the music festival and like arts scene locally and being inspired by those imagination portals. But my point is that if I had, you know, if I did learn some like mental skills, analytical thinking, you know, different lenses through which to analyze something, symbolic literacy to a degree, not in an occult sense, but in like language of film type sense and literature. And so those have value to me now. They do. But there wasn't a creative skill that produced something tangible. And it wasn't until I started actually self-teaching a skill, a few skills, that allowed me to create something physical and tangible that I could look at and go, oh, I made that, that I got past that empty feeling and started to feel fulfilled with my life. But it was a rough time. I'm not like saying, woe is me, poor me, but I just, my point being, I can't be the only one. And if I could reach that pinnacle of the goal of all of those years of education from kindergarten until I was 21 or 22, and that was the feeling at the end, and I'm a generally cheerful guy, you know, it's just not in my nature to be that way. It's got to be even worse for a lot of others out there who just are sort of on that track because it's what they were told to do or it's what they think mom and dad need them to do. So that's why overall, I think people would be better off learning a trade or a skill, even if it's something they didn't put into practice as a career, because it's never going to be a bad thing that you know how to do some carpentry or, you know, fix your plumbing, things like that. So anyway, I'll kick it back to you gentlemen, but that was one of the most significant crises of my life. And I needed to go through it to be who I am today, but man, maybe not everyone needs to go through that. Maybe there could be a different way.
Hmm. Hey, Gabriel, what would you like to say to that? I don't want to hog the mic here.
Thank you. I want to kind of bring on the masculine in the classroom. That sparked a lot of thoughts in me. I totally concur that there is an attitude to a masculine role model that my best role models were men. I'm just going to say that. The ones that really hit me in the heart that are still with me today, they were men. And they were very strong, like athletic. I had a couple in elementary school, we had a 6'6" and a 6'7" gym coach. And so I was literally brought up by Nephilim.
You're like 6'6" though.
And one of the poems that I got, that I earned at a young age and is still with me today. It's almost as though I fulfilled their impact on me. It's like they, because they were so large and they were large personalities, it encouraged me to fulfill my potential, like physically as well. But one of the poems I learned from Mr. Gaff, who was a giraffe, was the poem If by Rudyard Kipling. Are you guys familiar with the poem If?
I am, yes.
Yes. Yes. It is a very amazing poem. Okay, good. So in terms of bringing that masculine role modeling into the classroom, that poem has it all. It has it all. Now, Rudyard Kipling aside,
can I read that poem? It's not very long, Gabe.
He's something else. But that poem really had... Yeah, pop it off. Let me say this before I cut out. I learned that in Africa, if one of the men of the tribe shows a lot of success, if he stands out uniquely, when he comes back to his fellow tribesmen, and if he shows any pride in his success, it is incumbent on his fellow men to tell him, "Yeah, you did a really good job. So tonight you get to do extra dishes. Since you did so well, we're going to give you extra work. While you're high and mighty on yourself, we're actually going to fuel the flame with more expectation." And I think that is the essence of masculinity. It's like, "Oh, you think you did something good? Well, don't put that fire away. We're going to give you extra work while you're high on yourself." And that is very much encapsulated in the poem of If. And the word, that single title, If, is also the best one-liner of all of history. It was a retort from the Spartans. The Spartans got a threat from an invading force, and they were like, "If you do this and if you do that, we're going to come and take all your power away." And they're like, "Yeah, if." So it is. It's a very it's laconic, that single word title.
Do you have that chance, or do you want me to read it?
I've got it. I'd love to read it.
Great.
Okay, so Rudyard Kipling. "If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good, nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken and stoop and build them up with worn out tools, if you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss, and lose, and start again at your beginnings, and never breathe a word about your loss. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they're gone, and so hold on when there's nothing in you except the will which says to them, 'Hold on.' If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings, nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you, but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it. And, which is more, you'll be a man, my son." It's a good one.
Absolutely. I have that in my little poetry binder here. So you're quicker on the draw than I.
I should have let you have it. I mean, you got it in a binder. I just Google it.
No, that's a great poem anyway. Thank you, Gabriel, for that reference.
So, I mean, we're on the subject. Is there more that you've learned in the philosophy of pedagogy for the females versus the males?
Sure.
Not versus, but you know, differences, healthy expression of difference.
Yes, just to address just the two points there. So from yourself, Chance, and then also with Gabriel with the masculinity, and then to your latest point here about the ladies. So the time, I remember that too, that, you know, the time after school, you're like, what am I doing now? And I think getting back to the viewer who mentioned the trades, I think that would really help a lot of particularly boys out to really have that sense of mission and application, which is necessary, especially I think in the teenage years, to, you know, what am I doing this for, and so forth, and to have that hands-on interaction with the community, whether that's a trade school or whatever the case may be. And I often think of the Bob Dylan song, "I Dreamed I Saw St. Augustine Last Night," and there's a line in there speaking about the youth who have already been sold. And that's obviously a spinoff of the older Union song, I Dreamt I Saw Joe Hill Last Night. But in the Dylan song, the youth who have already been sold. And that's a tremendous aspect. Before I move to Gabriel's point about masculinity and then back to yourself, Chance, about that listlessness that, that we so often know after school. You know, that's another real drawback of this society is that people are spit out and they don't know what they want to do. I saw kind of an eccentric gentleman. He's called Badass Uncle Sam. He just does these street side talks about politics with people. But he was talking to this father and daughter, and the daughter was up on probably 18 or whatever. And, you know, he's asking, like, what are you going to do with your life? So here's a young woman who's come through the system. And here she is at 18 or 20 or whatever. And, she, you know, he asked her, what do you like to do? What do you like to do? And she said, I don't know. I don't know. You've had, I'm told it's 15,000 hours. I haven't done the math. I'll take people's word on it. You have 15,000 hours of school and you don't know what you like at the end of it. Well, there's a paucity there. There's a poverty there. And we go through school and then, like, we don't know what we're supposed to do when we're done. Anyway, I definitely know that feeling there, and I think the trades could ameliorate that.
Well, it's almost like the very idea of school itself is part of the psychological mindfuck, for lack of better words, that this is the container for learning, and it's arduous work that you don't like or that you have to do, whereas the truth is we ought to be learning all the time. I mean, that was how I pulled myself out of the malaise, was I told myself the only way that I'm going to change is if I make a priority to learn something every day that I can put into action. Even if it's like a 5-minute Adobe tutorial on how to do this one thing. And it's, I'm not even like, I'm in a good place in life now, so I don't even necessarily adopt that philosophy, but it's a winning philosophy that probably I should reconsider bringing it back in before I maybe start a decline or something. But the point being, you know, that idea of school as a notion might itself be part of the antagonism against the natural course of lifelong learning.
Mm. Yeah, we're hitting on that idea of application and its benefits. And now to Gabriel's point, before we get back to yourself, Chance, with the question about female education. But, you know, that's something we see in education across the board. And this is true for the tutoring and all of this is since World War II, which has set off a lot of trends in society, less and less men have been involved in teaching. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And time was the second a woman got married, she lost her job teaching. And that freed her up to go raise her family. And then it also kept that masculine presence in the schools. And again, because of the pay scales and so forth, men have gone less and less to be teachers. And then you have this whole tidal wave, which has come since the 80s, of, paranoia. And I'm well aware of mischief and criminal rings and all this stuff started with the Franklin cover up and the McMartin preschool. And there's this whole, and all the Epstein stuff since then. And, you know, that has driven men out of education. They're already going into the trades and things, getting out. But I mean, I can think of 6 men in this town who were accused over the decades now, of impropriety. And all that someone has to do to a man in these schools is just run their mouth. All 6 men were found innocent at inquest, but that didn't stop them from having their lives and careers ruined. And
yet I remember Joe Rogan praising a teenager who, you know, it came out in the news that he had inappropriate sexual contact with a teacher. And, you know, so the vice versa doesn't necessarily equate, you know, like the Joe Rogans of the world cheer on that inappropriate behavior. But like you said, it's just a finger point and it's hashtag me too, pound me too.
Yeah. And so there's that. And that's a whole topic, not just the sexual impropriety or its exaggeration in the public consciousness, but just the larger low trust society that we've developed, which is beyond these immediate points here. But that's a major dynamic that we really need to. What type of education do we want? What type of society do we want? If we want a high trust society, which seems pretty good for me, then we need to start inculcating that in the school. And that's part of why I'm saying we need to, in our rhetoric, step away from the adversarial and the enemy and so forth. But anyway, to Gabriel's point about the masculinity, it's very difficult because of these dynamics that I've laid out, economically and then culturally, with just the accusations and so forth. Anything you guys want to say about that before I get to Chance's point about female education?
Yes. This is, I'm not going to be able to articulate this perfectly, but I do know that some of what our law is based on from the Old Testament, once upon a time, had a system set up where false accusations were actually more detrimental on the accuser if they were proven wrong. And so there was a higher risk incumbent on the accuser to bring a case forward so that they could even be punished if it wasn't substantial enough. And I think whatever that dynamic was has been eroded detrimentally. But I think there is something to say about managing the pettiness of excessive accusation culture. That there should be some backlash, maybe even more backlash on the accuser.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense in a society that can philosophically be described as satanic, in the sense of being adversarial to life and the proper flow and function and order of operations of nature. That, you know, one of Satan's epithets is the accuser. So of course, in a society like that, the accuser would be put on the pedestal without the same level of scrutiny that perhaps a more balanced or just society would have fairly brought to the table. That's a really good point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the culture of see something, say something, and tip lines, and all of this jazz. And I was a couple of years ago, I was driving around and whatever, and a few months later, I get a fine because some busybody thought they saw me going around a school bus. Speaking of education, right? Who accused me? I have no idea who did that. But you don't even, you know, see, you get to see your accuser, you know, this is where we're at. And it's this low trust society of people skulking in the corners and trying to find skeletons in closets and all of this jazz. And it's not doing a bit of good for reality and truth. And it's not doing any good for the society of trust. But towards female education, again, here we have a country full of schools.
Well, I think
so many schools on top of schools.
Before we go to the female, we'll let Gabe take it.
Oh, yeah.
There we go. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for waiting. The phrase safe, secure is a phonetic anagram for sacrifice.
Ooh.
That's amazing to me. When I hear safe anymore, when I hear the phrase safe, I feel provoked. I feel provoked reflexively, and it's just I can't help myself nowadays, and probably for years to come, when I see the word safe, I'm angry because I know it's a lie. There ain't no such thing as safe. get me going. I just wanted to say safe and secure sacrifice. That's pretty profound.
Wow.
All right. I'm done.
That's a slick dissonant home run anagram right there. I will just say I'm probably not the only one with boomer parents that watch a lot of news, like, you know, local news network, where the only way there's any ratings, or I guess their philosophy about ratings, is let's talk about all the worst things that happened in town this week and just, you know, constantly harp on that. Like, oh, update, such and such car wreck, you know, danger, danger. The weather is going to kill everybody, et cetera. Right. So when I love my dad, my dad's great, but he has a tendency to, every time I see him when I'm leaving, he's like, stay safe, be careful, shit like that. And like you're saying, Gabe, it just, it just pisses me off. And I'm not mad at him. I just, like, I don't enjoy having that juju cast at me. Like, you're in danger, you know, like, and now to consider the anagram of sacrifice is fascinating. That's a really interesting point.
I was speaking to a local journalist, and they told me point blank that that is exactly what journalists do. They deliberately lead on the news with a disaster on the television news and the radio news, because they know it keeps eyeballs on them. They'll start with a house, and I see it on in the morning. Someone here turns on the thing at 6 o'clock in the morning. It's always some dude got run over, some dude got shanked, he got some house burned down, and those horrible things. And the only consolation,
because of that, one of the consequences is that, like, my parents' generation, anyway, the vast majority of them, they actually don't feel safe unless the TV's on. That's how the conditioning has really worked. Ultimately, it doesn't necessarily have to be the news, but, like, I can say confidently, a lot of people's parents that are my parents' age, they literally can't turn the TV off, or they are riddled with anxiety if it's not on. It could be muted. It's just got to be on somewhere nearby. It's a thing. So this isn't just to, like, rip on boomers, but that's the outcome of this kind of conditioning. I mean, if we're really talking about education, I don't think we need to tell this audience that the screen is not the educator. Right. But it's happening in our world today, just as the TV is the source of all knowledge for my parents' generation. The tablet or the phone is the source of all entertainment and all attention for a lot of kids being brought up today. And, you know, and that's filtered into the schools as well. So I don't mean to take us on that tangent, though. I do want to, feel free to respond to any of that, John, but. You know, I'm going to try to sit back and let you get to my last real question eventually, too.
Sure thing about the ladies. I mean, the only consolation I take in this manipulation of fear that you see in the media is this stuff could be made up. Joe Blow got run over last night. There probably isn't even a Joe Blow. I mean, there's all of that. That's a little consolation I take. Is, like, a lot of this stuff, I think, is just soundstage stuff. But anyway, that's a whole other topic. But anyway, maybe it helps the audience. Take it with a grain of salt. When that house five towns over burned down, there may never have actually been a house.
But or anyway. Like Handy Shook.
Yeah.
you can't say the real word on
yeah, that's YouTube, about but. 10 miles away. I know exactly what you're talking about. That I call that the soundstage, and one of the things I'm writing, that's the soundstage over there. Anyway, that's another time. To ladies, I think what we're getting out of this time together here is, ironically, for a nation of schools on top of master's degrees on top of doctorate degrees, we need to get back to roots, and we need to get back to reality. Oddly enough, we spent so long in these schools that we've forgotten reality. And part of that is, as we've now extensively talked about, the nature of men, and when it comes to education, wanting that application, wanting that hands-on for most men most of the time. And we spoke of the trades. Likewise with women. And it is going to, you know, buck up with what a lot of us were told growing up and things. But the reality is, as I'm seeing things and my generation and so forth, it would seem most women are really happy around babies, and they really like having babies. And so when it comes to ladies' education, in those teenage years, you know, they probably would do beneficial for most of them to have that home ec. And I don't mean just as a single course, but to really have a focus for most women on being good mothers and being good wives.
You know what would really do wonders would be education about what it's going to be like when you're pregnant. I'm sure that's most women, when they get pregnant for the first time, probably feel panic. Like, oh man, now I have to do this mountain of research and the clock is ticking. Whereas if they entered that development and change of identity that pregnancy is, already armed with confidence because they know what to expect at each step of the way, that could be a totally different experience for them. And I do biofield tuning now, which is a type of energy healing, right? And I can't tell you how many clients where we end up uncovering that the conditioning that they're struggling against has to do with the feelings of inadequacy or struggle that their mom was having while they were in their mom's womb. This isn't to like blame those mothers or make them the bad guy or anything. It's just that I'm just fully on board with what you're saying, that that would be a very fulfilling curriculum if we need such a thing, a curriculum for women. And I'll let you keep expanding on that. But man, that's a huge point.
Yeah. And then we really do need to, and Ilyich gets into that again in deschooling society, is to have that community interaction. Everyone, there's another beautiful word that's destroyed now, community, right? Everyone slaps that everywhere. So the food, everything's fresh. So the word fresh means nothing. Everything's a community now. So that means nothing. You could do a whole list of words of affection and you can see they've all been pigeonholed into just the sexual and they have much broader meanings. There's a little annoyance of mine. Words are misused so much, but to actually build in as we restore better than before, formal education and informal education too, to bring the community in, like you say, with women with child. And I went to the old folks home years ago. I tried to integrate some stuff there. They weren't interested because again, this is, everything's just a system. So they get the people in the old folks home. They're just ready. They probably got the coffins all measured out for all the geezers and they don't care about those people. They're just sitting there. I tried to go there and tried to do some stuff with the students and the administration didn't want anything to do with it. But get the old people involved, especially, you know, for younger and then for formal junior high and high school, get them. You have these people, they're just sitting there. They have knowledge and talents and they want to be really, they want to just sit in a room all day. And I don't think they want to watch TV. We have things. This is not rocket science, whether it's the people with child or young fathers. And you could do something like that for men or with old people. You have so much talent. But again, getting back to the whole enlightenment thing, everyone's just broken up into their own little spheres. I mean, you go into the middle of town here, you literally have the hospital, which has its own departments. No one talks to each other. Then next door is the old folks home. And they're just, you know, waiting to take the insurance money when those people die. Right across the street is a cemetery. There's the school. I mean, nobody's talking to each other. They're all just in ice cube trays. We need to really reintegrate things. And when the system falls, we need to really not make that mistake again.
Yeah, buddy. Gabe, you got some thoughts, man? I'm kicking it to you if you want.
Right on. Yes. You know, John, I'm thinking about how valuable it would be for high school age girls to be involved hands-on with the pregnancy, the delivery, the aftercare of a birthing center. Right? And this gives them context that a book cannot give them. And then also the benefit of having the youth interact with the elderly. This also is mutually beneficial because the elderly, just watching the youth interact, gives them life. You know, I think that the elderly absorb the vibrance of seeing young people, even from a distance, you know, just watching the way they behave. And I totally see a lot of benefit to that kind of a community service-based education for the school. Mm-hmm. And I want to also, just some a thought that I had a second ago. I have learned that one of my biggest weaknesses is pity. I'm an empath. And so when I see suffering in others, it hits me harder than I like to admit. And here later in my life, I'm like, dude, grow the hell up. You know, don't sympathize so much. But that's a hard lesson to integrate personally. And I'm not saying that pity is bad, but I believe that pity is the pit of despair. It leads to the pit of despair. This is coming through Nietzsche, so be careful. Be very careful. But at the end of Nietzsche's arc, he says that his ultimate obstacle to get over was to get over pity. And it was even hard for him. And I think that if you get rid of pity entirely, you lose your humanity. But in the future that I see coming for the generations to come, that pity is that charitable cause. It's like a pressure point that they know how to manipulate on people. And so I think it's a very delicate lesson to teach people not to let your pity lead you astray, and to keep your pity appropriate, current, to the now, to the present, and to not let it lead you along. So these are just some of the notes that I was writing down. And then when you said that it really, that language and the misuse of language is irksome, I'm of the same camp, my friend. And I've recently heard the idea that our language is our soul. And I was like, what? I never heard it. That's new to me. But then I think about, wait a second, they changed the definition of certain words in real time while we're in the middle of a crisis. These words don't mean what they used to mean. And I'm hurt deeply because they undermined the definition of our soul. Our soul doesn't attach to the reality they're painting out to pave this, you know, this path going forward. So these are just some of the thoughts I had. It's not really a question, but I thought I would just kind of bounce back some of some reflections from what you said there. Yeah, messing with language gets me too, big time. I'm very protective of language.
Well, let me give you some language shifting around pity, Gabe. Have you thought about where that word comes from? It comes from piety. So, which, you know, before it kind of had like this religious connotation, piety just meant fulfillment of your duty or obligation. So in yourself, man, instead of kind of giving yourself the old pity kick, like, oh, why am I having this, like, you know, difficult empathy that I don't want, or absorbing this negative energy, maybe in a sense, if you catch yourself in that moment of pity, remind yourself, this is my chance for piety. Like, is there a duty that I can fulfill, or can I just simply observe and revere the awesomeness of God or source in this moment, like as it's expressing through this low point that maybe I'm witnessing in somebody else, but recognizing that when we reach our lowest point, we are most open to change. So like there's a real juice and power in that moment of pity. But what I think, like, the, in terms of like the shifting of definitions and the black magic around that, or just the, how that reflects the drop in human consciousness, that what we typically, or people moderns typically experience when they have pity, is they're really looking down on someone. I'm not saying that that's you, but they're looking down on someone. They're like, oh wow, that person's got it bad, or they're really struggling, or they really suck. But if you really want to shift your pity to piety, then in a moment where you're feeling it, that type of empathy that hurts for somebody else, if you really emphasize the witness of how much potential they have for change in this moment, and that it's possible, and that it's grand, and, like, you know, that it's a metamorphosis moment potentially for them. But what often locks people into the low point is that they keep getting kicked while they're down by everyone around them witnessing that, you know, how much they're sucking or how much they're struggling. So you turn your pity to piety. You know what I'm saying? I think that that could really, your duty is to witness the potential that they have for change and growth in that moment and then give it to God as in God's hands or control. I think that there's like a lot of power in seeing that, that definition shift that the word pity came out of.
Great. Yeah. Thank you for that, Chance. Did you want to respond, Gabe?
I love that because part of the burden of pity for me is that there's nothing I do about it. I need some activation. I need a way to harness the feeling and put it to use. And there, this is, you know, find a duty, find a service. Use it for service. I love that. It's very, and that is, that's the thing. It's like, I don't want to sit here and stew. I want to make this beneficial. I love that. Piety. Great catch, buddy.
Yeah, there's a Roman version of the Odyssey, and it's called the Aeneid, and the character there is Aeneas, who's supposed to be the founder of Rome, and he goes on all these adventures like Ulysses does for the Greeks. And he's always referred to Chance's point, as pious Aeneas, and that's because piety does, classically speaking, have that idea of duty and public duty. And the enemy ruling class of this country in this world are very well aware of the power of pity, and that's why they have carefully fostered its cynical manipulation. We saw that with COVID. We saw that in our earlier discussion with what they do with news headlines and what they lead with. Well, why do they lead with that? Because they know people are compassionate, and they weaponize this stuff so often. The so-called woke people, I mean, underneath all of that nonsense is, for the dummies that get into that, I mean, there is a compassion there. That is not a bad thing. It's being manipulated by George Soros and a bunch of creeps. But underneath that, there, human pity and piety is a powerful thing. And that's why the enemy so marshals it to its own ends.
Yeah, buddy. So, okay. I think I only really want to open up one more can of worms. This one I kind of opened up before, but I'd, as somebody that's studied the philosophy of learning for so long and really enjoying this conversation, John, thank you for being here. I want to get back to this question that I think we didn't quite give you the space for, which is what is the philosophy around developing intelligence? You know, I see intelligence as a mutable thing. To give a few bullet points of what I think it entails is that a coherence between mind, body, and spirit equals intelligence. As I've witnessed in many people, their overall health quotient rising, their intelligence rises. I do not believe in the whole like IQ-based model, right? Where there's an innate intelligence you're born with and some people are born stupid. I think that health and intelligence are kind of hand in hand. And there's more things I could say about intelligence, but I just want to kick it over to you. And what are your thoughts about the, you know, the mutability of intelligence and how we can harness the truth of that to, you know, help ourselves to get ourselves out of a rut, or especially when it comes to giving our children the belief in their own ability to grow this thing called intelligence. Like, what is intelligence? I want you to riff on that, please.
Yeah. That's wowzers. That's a great question, Chance. And thank you for the opportunity to revisit this great topic here. And I'd like to hear what Gabriel thinks on the matter as well. But I think to a theme here and then some of my writings this year, the best way we can really approach intelligence, I would say that I would definitely agree with that idea before we talk about approaching it and fostering what is intelligence. I like that, what you say there, that being in tune with oneself and I would say it's also very much connected to that idea of wonder and pursuing knowledge. And that's going to be different for people at different stages of life, but to keep that spark alive so that you don't end up like that 20-year-old that doesn't know what they like when they're asked. So I think intelligence is bound up with that idea of wonder, keeping that alive, that holistic understanding of life, which this model just does not take account for. Literally, remember your schedule from high school? Come on, we all know this. It was just like a matrix of things that had nothing in common hour to hour. So part of that intelligence, I think, is seeing those connections, which is, I know my students get pissed off at this when I teach history and literature and they don't know what part of the book to take notes for. But you're trying to make those connections between things and to be able to jump around. And I think part of that is intelligence. And not just to, you know, make factual connections to this, that, or the other, but also to see things in a symphony, to see things in a symphony, or in a lowercase c, Catholic sense of all of reality is in this communication with each other. I mean, you speak about this amazing energy work that you're doing, and here you have temporally events that have they're not just been forgotten by people, like birth trauma. They weren't even remembered on the conscious plane necessarily, but yet there is a reality right now with that client of yours where that is affecting them even through space and time all these decades later.
Let me give an example of that. I had a client this week where the first fork that I hit, as soon as we opened the session, I immediately was aware that she had been in a serious car accident, and I knew when. I was like 2021, something like that. And it was true. It was bang on, because the energy of that kinetic impact, especially the head trauma, was still charged in her nervous system and interfering with her mental faculties to a degree, and had been part of informing a story about herself that wasn't true, that we did a lot of great work to resolve, but also discharging the energy of that impact. So, you know, this is an example though of how that like holistic model of intelligence works, that there's things that need to be accounted for. And especially with head injuries, you know, that there's like there's a physical energy that can get trapped in the nervous system from that type of thing. Anyway, that's a tangent, but it's amazing. It's amazing that that's been overlooked for so long and is still being largely overlooked.
Yes. It's really amazing. Again, in a nation of schools on top of schools, how much knowledge has been lost, whether that's plants and medical things that people used to know how to do with very simple items like baking soda or whatever, or silver, whatever the case may be, or this energy healing and whatnot. It is amazing how much we've lost with all of our institutionalized education. And I can't imagine that's completely innocent in the designers of the system. But getting back to intelligence, so as I'm laying it out here, that there's this spark of wonder that remains in the intelligent, that there is this symphonic understanding of reality. And then finally, and I'm sure we could kick it over to Gabriel here for his thoughts. But finally, I would say to have that spiritual consciousness, and that's a tremendous crime of modern Rockefeller pedagogy. I don't say the teacher on the corner or the school board. I'm not saying that. I'm saying the system that you would teach an individual about this earth, but you don't teach this individual why this earth exists or why they exist. You teach them all this stuff about reality, mostly just material reality, and maybe like some psychology or whatever. You teach them all of this stuff, but you never address why any of it exists. And part of what is intelligence is to have that spiritual sense and the metaphysical sense, however language you want to use, that there is something beyond just the quotidian. And maybe we wouldn't have a country that's jacked up on fentanyl and porno and liquor and things if you address these deeper problems. And so as to the intelligence, just to recap, that you have the wonder and that you have the symphonic understanding of reality and that you make an allowance for the numinous, let's say.
And I want to just refer to a take that I heard years ago from Mark Passio that it's always stuck with me. Back to the breaking down words, intelligence is intellect plus generative or gens, right? Mm-hmm. So it's the left and the right brain in unison, in harmony, something that's not accounted for in most models of education, you know, other than maybe art school. They kind of just shunt you over to the right side, but even teach it in a left brain way. So I don't even know that there is like a real right brain education model, but regardless, if there was such a thing, you're also getting the constant feedback of, but you're going to be starving if you go for the art route. My point being, you know, intelligence, I think, to truly exist in somebody or to blossom and develop in someone requires not just the stoking of the intellect, but that there is a creative output for that individual where they can put the intellect into practice creatively so that there's that left, right brain, harmonious, you know, activation and the inspired to learn element that comes out of the necessity one runs into when they're creating. I mean, simply put, with all the other things I've said about intelligence, how health and just overall mind, body, spirit coherence are the factors for the development of it, that whenever somebody does have a creative pursuit, something that they just really love and is important to them, and they want to get better at it, back to like this skills-based approach to learning, that, and I think this applies to beyond probably even art, but just anything that you want to develop in yourself, period, that there is a necessity that one will run into. It's inevitable that to ascend your skills past a certain level, it's not just about you getting better at that skill. You have to get better. Like there's the quality of your attentiveness has to change. The, your health has to improve. Like all these different metrics have to raise together for your skills to be able to pass a certain threshold, or you will be at a plateau as long as you're ignoring these facets of who you are. And so that's like a big part of why creativity does spark one's intelligence to grow, because it is just part and parcel of the creative's path that to get better, to really keep going on that path, which I think is the most true and innate spiritual path a human can take as well, is creating something or many things that, the intelligent or the health has to be addressed. The overall being has to be addressed for that to develop. So intelligence is intellect plus generating something, and you have those in combination and authentically pursuing it. All these other parts will make themselves self-evident that they're a requirement. I think that's a huge factor.
Well, it's just like before we hear from Gabriel here, it's just like was said earlier, you have all the nuts and bolts stuff that's taught in class, and then mental health is something you have to take care of privately. And the same thing, you know, there's not even accounted. I should say, in fairness, there is some attempt, but this is the problem with the mainstream pedagogy, is you have some attempts to get, you know, mental health addressed, or to get even the spiritual stuff. They have some of these meditation classes in schools or whatever, but it can only go to a certain point. And the same with what you were just saying here, Chance, as well, is like spirituality that's meant to be taken care of elsewhere. And that's really the block that we're having with the model, is that the good things are only allowed to go so far because of the ultimate soulless telos of the Rockefeller system. Anyway, that was just my thought before I kick it to Gabriel here.
Kicking it to Gabe. Gabe, are you home? Oh, maybe he's just a little further behind. Okay, cool. Let him have it.
Hi, buddy. I love that you brought the word symphony into intelligence. That's perfect. I really love that. One thing I wish that I had in my education was more encouragement and even fostering of debate, like civil debate, is relegated to the field, to the athletics. And people think that winning is a matter of physical conflict. And I think that I would have benefited greatly from learning how to debate at a younger age, so that in my later days, I'm ready to go when it comes. I'm a contrarian. But I think I should have learned these things earlier for conflict resolution. I think that's something that might be lacking and beneficial. But eventually there's a symphony of one person makes a claim and the other person finds a way to eventually see eye to eye. Maybe not right away, but got to work to come in together and see eye to eye. But I just love that you said the symphony, because there's a discord at first, but then in the end, that's something I love about a good debate. Mm. A good debate is at the end, only the ideas have been addressed. And when you're done with the debate, the two people are still friends. They're still, nobody lost anything because it was about the ideas and not the person. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that I would have benefited from. And I have one more really just random fact. I know I'm just kind of scattered all over the place, but I want to share this thing I've learned. The Greek word agon, A-G-O-N. It's a character. I think the agon is a character who is born from zeal and victory. Zeal and victory had a baby, and its name was Agon. In this Agon, I see it as the North Star. I see it as the Pole Star. It is this high ideal that we all share. It's this unmoving mover, this prime directive kind of the present and centered. I think changes from generation to generation to the Agon changes over time. And so my Agon is not the same Agon that my daughter is going to grow up with. But something interesting about that is the zeal and the victory. The parents of the Agon, the parents of this high ideal, are competitive. One wants to win, and one has already won. You know, the zealot, the zeal, is like has something to prove. But the mother, she already won. She already has had victory. And there's a symphony in that of being like having a drive, but also having the confidence that, a balance in between. So I just kind of wanted to share that. And then to make things a little weird, I think that the Agon is what is. And
I'm sorry, we missed that.
In the Romans, they held their hand upward. Can we go back to that point? The Bellamy salute was palmed in the path of this gesture, where it became a palm down, and that's when it got gnarly. That's when it got real gnarly and turned into the Sig Heil. And so I just wanted to put the Agon in people's mind and maybe cleanse what you thought that gesture meant, because originally it was not like this. It was like this. And that is like venerating a high ideal, excellence, putting excellence back in your heavens. And I think it also has to do with the ego and the egg. But yeah, I just wanted to share some of these things about of it is in our relationship to it.
Hmm.
Thank you for that.
It's almost like bringing us full circle back to what you're saying about social skills being work, because that's basically what the agonies were in the ancient Greek concept, was like contests, games, gatherings, things of that nature. And interestingly, bringing that salute, it's like the difference being pushing something down or holding something up. But it's so, so interesting, how the word agony has shifted too, that now we see those type of things, or not we, but you know, the collective tends, the fictional collective that doesn't even exist, the conceptual collective, you know, individuals that we know that act collectively tend to see these ideas of like a public contest or even gathering as agony by the Merriam-Webster definition to modern English. Super interesting.
And that reminds me of the beautiful, it's one of the greatest statues from the classical world. It's Winged Victory, and a lot of it's damaged, but you can see what it was. It's very symmetrical and very graceful. Winged Victory, and you can see the arms, or what's left of the arms, doing exactly that salute that Gabriel had mentioned there. And that really is such a great way to bring things full circle, is, you know, the symphony. One of the problems I see in a lot of alternative education, and this is just a phenomenon really of the larger society, is that everyone is bunkering down in these very specific ideologies. And because our own schooling was so mechanized and so forth, we that's one of the biggest reasons we've lost this sense of community, and everyone is just isolating in their own little ideological, spiritual bubbles. And that's one of the best things a school rightly lived can do to a society, is be this common ground. People, you know, people have their own ways of looking at the world and their own communities, but that's really what a school can do, especially in such a society as America, which is a very diverse country on multiple fronts, that the school offers this truly common ground where people can, just like Gabriel was describing the debate properly understood, you know, can talk about ideas and still be friends and make connections and still, you know, believe what they believe and all of that. And I think it's such a salve, such a medicine to this this shattering of life that we're seeing in America now. I mean, a lot of us, even I imagine, speaking to the audience here, you know, we see the agenda, we see the wicked people and the conspiracies and the New World Order and all that. And then we've, you know, maybe circled the wagons, but we need to also be careful to a theme of this whole recording, is when this thing comes down, we're going to have to rebuild all this. So we have to have these places of common discourse, and schools properly lived are such places.
And this has been a riveting chat, John. I think we ought to let you talk more about the Institute as we close. And of course, any finishing thoughts on other subjects we've opened would be great. I do see, and I think it ought to be mentioned, all the different offerings that, you know, people can find out about through your website. It's particularly interesting, I'm seeing here, Latin Tuesdays. So can you talk about, you know, your organization and the things on offer? And I mean, it's probably too much to actually give in a wrap up, but you know, what you'd like people to know about, the floor is yours.
Sure. Thank you so much, Chance, for that. So everyone who's interested may go to apostasiasinstitute.wordpress.com.
And that's linked in the show description if, you know, that's too intimidating to spell.
Thank you. Too many I's and S's for sure. Thank you for that, Chance, for linking it there. So there you go. It's in the description. And once you go there, you can learn all about our philosophy, and hopefully gave a big plate of that today in the discussion here that Chance was so kind to invite me to with Gabriel. But also, by way of practical offerings, we're having a seminar come up at the end of this month, as we're celebrating our 10th anniversary. Part of that is a seminar in person here in Connecticut, but also it's going to be broadcast on StreamYard, actually, when the time comes. And it's on what would education look like if nobody was looking? And what I mean by that is, especially for grade school education, because we're thinking about getting into co-op, offering a co-op and things like that, and kind of in that unschooling model, for younger students, what would, for parents or for students or even for teachers, everyone's invited, what would education look like if you weren't concerned about the in-laws and what the state said and the requirements? And if education was all that mattered in the child, what would that look like? So that's what that seminar is about coming up. We have other things as well. We have the Fearology Center people can check out, and the academic research, the cutting edge research that Dr. Fisher is involved with. We have on May Day, which is a labor holiday. We have the Folk Music and Social Change Center opening up with Paula DeAngelis and David Rovix, the musician, and we have such treasures in them. And then for, and this will be my final ad, I could go on for quite a while, for people who are interested in enrolling in our classes, we have starting up again in the summer our Latin reading sessions. Those are free and open to anyone who wants to join in that community. And they're all skill levels are available there. And that's a great way to figure out if you would like to take a formal class with us. And then also we have the open events series. We have the open events series where different lectures are offered. And that's a good place to find out how you might expect the classes at Apakasistasis to be. There are also sample classes that we have on the website, all of these little tabs and so forth. And we have other works as well. And perhaps later this year, I'll have the opportunity to speak about that. So there's a whole lot there. And I really thank Chance and Gabriel for the opportunity to be here this evening. It was a delightful time.
I'd like to RSVP for Latin Tuesdays. That sounds really good. I'd like to take my Latin reading skills from, you know, knowing some words and some etymology to put in sentences together. That sounds fun. But we'll be wrapping it up now. Gabe, if you got any closing thoughts you want to hit the people with, I'll pass it to you. Okay, looks like we're good. Okay, so, oh wait, here he comes. All right.
Okay, thank you. Thank everybody for the patience with my signal. It's so funny. Sometimes I wonder, what would ever happen? Would it be like dry, clear signal for once? John, it has been a real pleasure. It's been a real pleasure. It's great to meet you. And I'm excited about looking into the academy and learning more. I'm even very much enticed by the event at the end of the month. So yeah, you may hear from me in the future. That sounds kind of up my alley, especially that aspect of the folk culture. I look forward to future encounters.
As yep. do I, Gabriel. Thank you for that. It was a pleasure meeting you as well.
Yeah, John, and you've got a, you know, invitation back if you want to bring a subject on, just run it by me. And, you know, we all liked this conversation a lot, I think. And thanks to the audience for being here, showing up for probably the most important aspect of life in many ways is the willingness and ability to learn. I mean, what else, if we were to peg a meaning of life on why we're here besides just for the sake of being here, then learning obviously takes the universe as university, learning takes the cake as a very important subject. So it's been as Cucumber says, it's been a delightful evening. Good to see you, buddy. I'm glad you've been here, and we'll catch everybody later for the next Interverse coming on Monday. Got a really exciting one for you guys. I'm not going to tease it past that, but suffice to say, the herbalists will be happy. And check the episode description for all the ways you can support my channel or me. Particularly, you know, my favorite one being to get a biofield tuning. They are profound and the, like usual, running about 4 or 5 weeks out on booking. So if you are interested and you'd like it to be sooner than later, then, you know, hit me up and I'll catch you guys next time. Love you all and keep on learning. Good night.
Goodbye.